Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time once again. Welcome to the Veterans Radio Podcast. Cyrus Raymond here from the Legal Help for Veterans Studio in Northfield, Michigan. Just want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. And would also like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. But until then, let's take it back to Dale Thornberry right here on Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thornberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to another Veterans Radio program here at WAAM 1600 Talk Radio. We welcome into our program today. I want to thank or wish everybody a happy Easter and hope that you're able to get together with family and friends sometime during the day and just be thankful for what we've got in this gorgeous country that we are in.
What was Easter like in Vietnam?
Sorry for the pause of dead silence. I'm trying to
Did
don't think there was
mission?
Any difference. I think probably the... those that were probably a little bit more religious than I was might have gone to Catholics. I always had mass, it seemed like.
I mean, did they have a mission that day?
We flew
every day. It was another day, right?
It was just another day. The only days we would get off were usually, well, you didn't get them off, but they would have a ceasefire sometimes during around Christmas or Thanksgiving and things. I don't remember one. Because I was a new pilot in April of 1969, and I think I'm trying to remember what was going on. I was looking that up the other day.
They didn't send you there for an Easter egg hunt.
No, we were looking for other stuff. But April 8th, 1969, I became an aircraft commander. So what's that, 45 years ago? Something like that? Got my own helicopter. That was kind of cool. That was fun.
What was the name of your helicopter?
Sky Chief 188.
Well, did you give it, you know, like little
We didn't give them names like they did World War II aircraft. They just, you know, we just had the little tail number on them, and that was it. It was all painted up nice and clean. It was a nice helicopter. It didn't survive, unfortunately. When they left Vietnam in 75, which again is another one of those anniversaries, is that it was one of the ones that got thrown overboard.
So it's in the China
Sea. It's in the
Sea.
South China Sea somewhere, I guess.
Well,
hey, you know.
Archaeologists will find it.
That's right.
Did you leave any chewing gum there?
No, probably underneath the seat. There probably might be some in there. I want to remind our audience today that we are going to be talking with Mark Harris, and he's written a great book called Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War. And you guys got to stick around for this one. This is a great story. Not only are we going to learn about these five great directors that all of us grew up with watching as the westerns and, you know, romantic comedies and all kinds of things like that, but just the history of what was going on just before World War II,
they
I think it's going to be fascinating.
They played a huge role.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's going to be I'm anxious to talk about this.
I was I saw them after the more mm-hmm. in the late 40s when they were being rerun. Remember Victory at Sea?
Oh yeah.
Who directed that? I wonder this
maybe
guy.
Maybe you know.
Yeah.
That was on NBC. I remember that because I remember watching it and the waves and they were playing.
Oh man! Oh, I didn't miss it. Sunday morning. It was like 10 o'clock Sunday morning.
It would be that. All excited about having this guest on the program, and I was looking through the music that we have for World War II and all these songs that my mom would play and my dad and she, my mom and dad would dance.
Dance in the dining room,
the living room. And,
and he and my brother, folks, and then we did my family did the same thing. We danced.
So they were everywhere. But anyway, so folks, I want to welcome Mark Harris to Veterans Radio. He's the author of Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. The story of five Hollywood directors who decided that America had a good story to sell, and they wanted to sell it. So, Mark, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am really excited to talk to you about this book. And I guess the thing that I found so fascinating was at the beginning was all of the intrigue and everything that was going on in the country prior to Pearl Harbor. Could you talk a little bit about how these famous directors, and as we mentioned their names, I think most of our audience will recognize them, how they decided to make this jump to work for the military.
Sure. Well, the book is about these five directors, William Wyler, John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston, and Frank Capra, who, by the time of Pearl Harbor, were five of the biggest directors in Hollywood, and they all accepted officers' commissions in the Army, or in Ford's case, joined the Navy, to leave Hollywood for the next 3 or 4 years and become documentary makers or propagandists, which was not really a dirty word back then, for the war effort at the invitation of the War Department.
Well, I know that Capra and some of the other ones were motivated by the propaganda that the Nazis were putting out.
They were. Capra was called to Washington, D.C. by George Marshall. Capra was really meant to be the kind of hub of the whole operation. The other directors would go around the world, basically, filming the war, but Capra would be put in charge of making what were then called morale films, the Why We Fight series of 7 one-hour films that was intended not for public consumption, but to be shown to new recruits. And he was asked to make these movies, but he had almost no budget to do it because the War Department wasn't going to spend, you know, precious resources on movies. So he saw some Nazi propaganda films, including Triumph of the Will, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and got the really brilliant idea, sort of a moment where necessity is the mother of invention, to take all of these Axis propaganda films that had been seized by the Treasury Department and use that footage in these Why We Fight films to show young Americans, 18, 19, 20 years old, what the enemy was up to.
Yeah, that was there was a lot of resistance to getting involved in World War II at this time. And
right.
In fact, that film that you were talking about, The Triumph of the Will, that was being shown around the United States to all of these pro-German groups.
Yes, in New York City, where I live, there was a movie theater right in Manhattan on 86th Street that was known as a pro-Nazi movie theater and would routinely, up until the beginning of the war, show Nazi propaganda to the German émigré audience in that neighborhood. And there was by no means unanimity about the war. In fact, just before Pearl Harbor, Washington held hearings where the heads of all of the movie studios were ordered to come and account for themselves because they were being accused of creating interventionist propaganda. In other words, they were being accused of trying to drag America into the war for their own interests. The isolationist strain in America, both in Washington and in the population was really considerable right up until Pearl Harbor.
Well, I was interested in at the beginning of the book when you're talking about these directors and some of the movies that they were making, especially Capra with his Mr. Deeds and Mr. Meet John Doe and so on and so forth that he's making that were kind of all these idealistic. In fact, Capra didn't really want anything to do with going to war, it sounded like, at the time.
That's right. Capra's politics were really funny, and if you only knew his work from, for instance, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you wouldn't necessarily guess that he was a conservative Republican. He boasted that he never voted for FDR in one of his four elections. He was really anti-labor union. It's funny because he had this populist reputation, but even though politically he was not always in agreement with Roosevelt, he was very impressed by him as a president and by a man, and was totally convinced by Roosevelt's belief that we were going to have to fight this war. So really, as from the time that Capra became an officer, he was 100% on board with serving his country and serving the mission. There was never any wavering on his part.
Well, we'll come back to Frank Capra. I want to go to John Ford. And all of us know John Ford from his westerns more than anything else. He was, credited with finding John Wayne, and he did Stagecoach, and he also did a lot of other very powerful films. But he enlisted in the Navy before anybody.
He did. Ford was one of the first people in Hollywood to believe that, not only to believe that war was inevitable, but to believe that filmmakers, cameramen, soundmen, editors were going to have a really vital role to play in the war, which is now we think, you know, well, of course the war would be filmed, but you know, if you think back to the beginning of World War II, sound movie making was only about 10 or 12 years old. So it was still, you know, a much newer medium to all of America than, for instance, the Internet is to us now. But Ford had this idea that camera crews were going to be necessary. So all through 1941, he sort of created this weekend Naval Reserve Gentlemen's Club where he got guys from the studios to come and basically drilled them and trained them in, for instance, what it would be like to have to develop film on a listing ship or how to shoot camera, you know, how to shoot film under wartime conditions. And the idea was that if war started, this would be a kind of useful reserve for the Navy to have. In fact, they never became a reserve. They pretty much all went in as soon as war started, and they became really essential to the effort to record the war. But Ford actually left Hollywood 3 months before Pearl Harbor. He essentially stopped working as a movie director and joined the Navy.
I find it fascinating that the people at the time had the foresight to start putting these whole organizations together, not just the Navy, but also the Army, the Department of Defense, and there were a lot of conflicts of who controlled what, and it took them a long time to get it all straightened out, didn't it?
Yeah, a lot of them. Capra, I know, said that working for movie studios and fighting with studio heads was very good preparation for him in battling War Department bureaucracy, because it took 6 months or so to decide whether this was a propaganda effort or a war effort or who would be in control of it. And while that was being fought out, the directors just sort of rolled ahead and did what they wanted and kind of made their own plans.
I was interested in the first couple of films that some of these people, I guess I'm jumping around here a little bit with you. We're talking with Mark Harris. He's the author of Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. And I think it was John Huston, and you can correct me on this. We've got a couple of minutes. He went in and he had to make these training films. And for those of us that have been in the military, some of these training films, especially about the spreading of social diseases.
What to watch out for when you go into town.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually John Ford.
Okay,
that was his very, very first assignment.
No relation to the auto folks.
No.
So.
Let's not cut off our sponsorship here, right? But anyway, he had to make a graphic film about the spread of social diseases, right?
He did, and it's funny because you know, as opposed to someone like John Huston, who had, you know, a girl in every port and sort of saw the war as a big adventure, Ford was extremely prudish and didn't talk about sexual relations or anything like that at all. Didn't make those jokes. And for him to have to oversee, like, the most graphic thing, and if anybody is curious, by the way, about any of these movies, I should say that they're all available on the Internet, on YouTube, for free. You can stream them, and most of them are quite short. But Ford later said that after he finished making this film, which was called Sex Hygiene, he left the room and threw up. He was so horrified by it.
And the way he describes it in the book, it's very graphic. You know, of what these various diseases do to a young man. So
yeah.
Don't go into town on that. Again, we're talking with Mark Harris, author of Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War. But you mentioned, or I want to go to John Ford again after it, just a second, Robert.
Okay, Dave.
After Pearl Harbor, John Ford was sent out to Midway. And this is something we have covered on our program quite a lot, the Battle of Midway. Could you tell us a little bit about what he found there and what he was able to accomplish?
Yeah, it was a really remarkable episode in that Ford didn't even know what he was being taken to until he got to Midway. Even when he got there, he assumed that he was being asked to make a nature documentary about life on a remote, you know, Pacific outpost. And only then was he told that an attack was imminent, that the American forces were prepared for it, and that he was going to be asked, starting very, very early in the morning, to stand on the roof of a power station and film the Japanese enemy planes flying overhead and the American response. And Ford and two very junior cameramen that he brought with them filmed the battle, or filmed, you know, the pieces of the battle that they could see from their various vantage points. And the movie that resulted, this film called The Battle of Midway, first of all, made Ford a national hero because he literally filmed until a piece of shrapnel knocked the film loose from the camera and the camera out of his hand, but he was able to save it. He turned it into an 18-minute movie, which was the first time that American home front audiences had seen any sign that the war in the Pacific was starting to turn and starting to go the way of the Allies. And that movie was shown eventually in three quarters of all of the movie theaters in the United States. It was the first documentary film to show Americans in actual combat. It was the first time people got to see images of the war on color film, which was really unusual back then. Color was more reserved for fantasies and musicals and spectacles. So it really was kind of, for many Americans, the first movie glimpse of what the war actually looked like, and Ford was behind it.
I found it fascinating because that was one of the ones I went and looked at on YouTube, and it was so graphic in some standpoints that they kind of had to clean it up a little bit because they didn't think that the American audience was prepared to see what was really going on.
Well, I think that, you know, one thing about color for news, it was so unusual that they wondered if, you know, a big yellow and orange fireball with black smoke trailing out of it against this brilliant blue sky, you know, you see some of the most graphic bombing of that battle, and the narration, which is pretty dominant in the movie, goes silent for several minutes. And then the first thing you hear when the narrator returns is his voice saying, "Yes, this really happened." And it's almost as if he had to tell American audiences, you know, it's okay, you can believe your eyes, what we're showing you is real.
I would encourage people to go and watch this. Was Walter Houston one of the narrators? Because I know that Henry Fonda was involved.
Henry Fonda and Jane Darwell, who were the son and the mother in The Grapes of Wrath, which Ford had just made the year before, were voices in it. And then there were two other voices. I'm not sure that Walter Houston was one of the voices. There's a very sort of serious, it's not Walter Houston, actually, it's Donald Crisp,
that's right,
who was the father in How Green Was My Valley, another Ford film. And then a young director, actually, used as a voiceover named Irving Pichel. So it's an interesting movie because there's four voices kind of competing for your attention. Two of them are straight-up narrators, and two of them are almost like meant to be two people sitting next to you in the audience, as if you were listening to them comment excitedly on what they were seeing on screen.
Yeah, it's a great little film to watch because you can see the camera shaking, and that was the other thing, is that he was so close to the bombing that you could feel the vibrations of that. You had a question?
Yeah, well, it's not a question. I have a comment, Mark, and you can comment on this because what I see and I still like today is that the way it was shot, I like the black and white more because I love the contrasting, and you got to see the action straight. I mean, that was what was really going on almost in real time. But yet, when it came to the movies, there was contrived. The Japanese, now I'm not, there's no side, right?
Yeah.
But there was a Sands of Iwo Jima. Well, there were guys talking in a foxhole, and the Japanese just don't jump in or what. They slither like snakes and slither over the logs and slither down, kill these guys, and slither. They didn't jump up and run out, which most 99% of the world would do. They slithered back out. And then there was the other movie about the Seabees, the fighting Seabees, with William Frawley. He's an Irishman, and a lovable Irishman from Boston, and he's singing an Irish lullaby when a Japanese sniper, buck teeth, the glasses, the whole thing, puts a bullet in him. Now, that's a bit contrived, rather than the realism that you saw with the newsreel type footages. So, comment on that contrast. That Hollywood was, I mean, boy, when we were kids and we saw that, we hated the Japs bad.
This is one of the really interesting things I learned in the course of doing the research for the book, that when you hear about propaganda and you hear that the War Department told Hollywood what kind of things to put in their movies, you kind of automatically think, well, that must have been bad. The War Department must have been sort of pursuing their own ends, and filmmakers may have said, like, well, we want to show this, and the War Department would have said, well, no, you can only show it this way. But in fact, what you're talking about in terms of the depiction of Japanese enemy fighters, that was a moment where the War Department was actually sort of ahead of Hollywood in what they wanted on screen. It was Hollywood's instinct to show these guys and often refer to them not even as human. I mean, the worst of those depictions in what were then called hate pictures made during the war, movies like Blood on the Sun or Behind the Rising Sun, they would refer to the Japanese, not just soldiers, but people, as rats, as dogs, as monkeys. And the War Department started putting considerable pressure on Hollywood not to do that. They said, you know, we are going to win this war eventually, and we're going to have peace, and probably we're going to have peace and have to have some kind of relationship with Hirohito, who we certainly don't expect is going to be killed in this war. And you have to start, you know, at least depicting the Japanese, not the enemies, but the Japanese as human beings. I mean, one other big problem in Hollywood movies of the time was a widespread tendency to depict Japanese Americans all as double agents.
Right.
And that was something that the War Department really objected to, but for their own purposes. They objected to it because they had, you know, tens of thousands of Japanese Americans in internment camps, and for a while, what they had been planning to do was resettle those internees in different towns and cities and villages throughout the South and the West. You know, not too many to a town, but just sort of scatter them all over the place. And they felt that if Japanese Americans were depicted by Hollywood as being dangerous and untrustworthy, that no towns in America would accept them. So, it's really interesting to see what Hollywood did, what Hollywood was pressured not to do, and what the motives behind that pressure were.
Well, there's a lot of this, again, in the book. I encourage people to read this because you address this subject, I think, really well. I'm talking with Mark Harris here on Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War. We've got about 15 minutes to go, so I need to get into, let's talk about John Huston and what he did. He was a well-known, just actually a beginning director, but he's well-known because he had just filmed, where did it go? It
was the Maltese Falcon,
that's right. So tell me a little bit about him.
Right, well, you're right. He was well-known, but he was just starting out. He was younger than the other directors and had just had his first breakthrough film. He had been working as a screenwriter mostly before then. And Huston thought the war was going to be a big adventure. He probably gave less thought to the sort of patriotic side of it than maybe the other four guys I wrote about did. He thought it was going to be a lot of fun and went in and discovered that it really wasn't. And Huston had a couple of really interesting experiences during the war. One was that he was assigned by Capra to make a documentary about the liberation by the Allies of an occupied Italian village. And he got to the village after it had already been liberated, but the village was still abandoned and filled with German, you know, tripwires and booby traps. And so he restaged the entire battle with the enthusiastic endorsement of the army. And the resulting film, which was called The Battle of San Pietro, was passed off as documentary battle footage by the War Department. They even made up a story about how Huston and his men were so brave that they advanced in front of the first line so that they could then turn their cameras around and show the first, you know, set of troops advancing. It was, everything in the movie is completely staged. So that was a sort of rough moment in war propaganda history. And then Houston had an extraordinary experience after the war, when he was asked to make a movie, about psychologically scarred veterans who were receiving psychiatric treatment in a veterans hospital. The purpose of this movie was to show that, veterans could be cured really quickly and that American businesses could rehire them. But the movie that, resulted, which is called Let There Be Light, was so upsetting, that the War Department banned it for 35 years.
Wow.
And Houston thought he had done a good job, and in many ways he really had, but the first part of the movie, which is where you see just how damaged and hurt and shaken up the veterans are, was something the War Department really did not want the public to see.
And I've heard about this film, and it's something that we're going to be talking about later on as we come up to one of our programs on post-traumatic stress later on this year. But, okay, so we've got a couple of other well-known directors that we want to get to. So let's talk a little bit about William Wyler. William Wyler was, he had just finally gotten up to the point where his 1942 picture, Mrs. Murnivar, had been up for an Academy Award, and he was a Jew who had left Germany, right?
Well, it was it was a part of France that he grew up in that at various times either was or was not under German control. So, like when he was a teenager during the First War. So, the war was very personal to him, and he tried to get as many as 25 or 30, family members and friends from his town, out of Europe as war was approaching. But yeah, Wyler made Mrs. Miniver, which was a huge, huge, success in both America and England. It's the story of a small English village that kind of erases all of its snobberies and class distinctions and petty disputes to band together during, World War II. And the shooting of that movie took place about half before and half after Pearl Harbor. And it was rewritten after Pearl Harbor, especially the ending, to make it much clearer that this village wasn't just something to be sympathetic to. It was meant to be an example for American audiences to follow. And then Wyler himself went in and filmed the great documentary of the air war, The Memphis Belle, and had a sort of extraordinary experience where he was filming in an unpressurized plane footage of the Italian coast for another documentary, and in one stroke lost his hearing. He went completely deaf, and 24 hours later was out of the army and essentially returned home a disabled veteran who thought his directing career as well as his army career was probably over. And he took all of that pain and frustration and uncertainty and poured it into his next movie, the first movie he made as a civilian after the war, which is The Best Years of Our Lives, which is, you know, one of the great American masterpieces, I think, about period, but especially about returning veterans.
And it's an extremely powerful movie for people that were looking at it probably in 1946. I think it might be a little bit different today, but even so, it's still a powerful film.
I've shown it to people in the last year in movie theaters since the book came out, and you'd be surprised at how emotional people still find it. On a big screen, it's still a really strong experience.
I think movies shown on a big screen always have much more emotional appeal than on a 32-inch flat screen
right.
TV, you know, or whatever that happens to be. I want to get to George Stevens here also and talk about his experiences when he, was asked to end up filming in Europe as the American troops were moving across.
Yeah, Stevens had an extraordinary wartime experience. You know, he was one of the guys who signed up because he felt it was absolutely the patriotic thing to do. Very happy-go-lucky guy. He had started in Hollywood in the 1920s making Laurel and Hardy shorts. And Stevens was all over the place in the war. I mean, he was in North Africa. He filmed the liberation of Paris and the liberation of France. He was there with his camera crews in the Battle of the Bulge. He and Ford co-supervised the filming of D-Day. But probably the wartime footage that Stevens is most remembered for is that in May 1945, he and his men were the first American camera crew into Dachau just after it had been liberated. And, you know, we have to cast our minds back to a moment when we didn't really yet know what the Holocaust was and the extent of German atrocities was not yet fully known, and imagine what it was like for Stevens and his men to walk through the gates of that camp and see what they saw. And almost immediately, Stevens realized that his job was no longer to create propaganda or to make a documentary, that he and his cameras were there to gather evidence. And in fact, that's exactly what he did. He filmed and filmed and filmed, and the footage that he compiled was used as evidence in the Nuremberg trials.
The way that you describe it in your book, we were talking with Mark Harris, author of Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War, you can see how he was so affected by what he was seeing for the first time. In fact, I think one of the things you describe is he saw somebody, but he didn't think it was a living person, and he just couldn't believe it. And the people, of course, were so happy to see the American troops there. And that he's the one that, you know, the pictures that you see of the Holocaust, of the bodies in the boxcars and in the crematoriums and so forth, many of those were taken by him. So you know that had to affect him for the rest of his life.
Yes. I mean, from a movie perspective, when you look at Stevens' career, it's really interesting because he seems to be one kind of great director before the war and a different kind of great director after the war. I mean, before the war, he was famous for things like Swing Time and Alice Adams and Woman of the Year with Hepburn and Tracy, a lot of really light, fun comedies. After the war, in the 50s, he becomes the director of Shane and A Place in the Sun and The Diary of Anne Frank and Giant, I mean, really serious movies, but all dramas. He said that after what he saw at Dachau, he felt that he would not ever be capable of making a comedy again, and he never did.
You mentioned earlier about that these directors covered the invasion of Normandy and so forth, but there were a lot of problems with that invasion of Normandy. Can you tell us about the physical demands that were there and what happened to them?
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary idea to try to film this on a scale that the Army had certainly never done before. There were hundreds of cameras mounted to the prows of the American and Allied vessels. There were dozens of trained cameramen. About 90% of the equipment and 90% of the footage was destroyed in the initial attack. That still left a lot, but of that remaining footage, the majority of it was considered much too bloody and frightening and unusable to be shown to American newsreel audiences who, you know, newsreels changed every week, and American audiences were just frantic to get the first, you know, the first scenes from the invasion. So what they saw was the stuff that was reasonable to see, but you have to wait almost, I think, 50 years until Steven Spielberg made Saving Private Ryan. The first 25 minutes of that movie, which is, you know, D-Day, that footage is largely based on the footage that Stevens helped oversee that was not shown originally because it was just too rough.
Oh. And the beginning of that movie I thought was very rough.
Right.
That was hard to watch.
You can imagine, and that was 1998, so you can imagine how impossible it would have been, you know, in 1944 for people, you know, used to seeing fairly sanitized Hollywood movies to look at that.
Well, as we come up to toward the top of the hour when we start thinking about, you know, unfortunately wrapping this up, what would you say, what do you think was the overall effect that these directors had on the war movement for America? There's a short question for you.
Well, you know, I think they did two things. One is Capra very directly, you know, you didn't get into the Army after a certain point without seeing those Why We Fight movies. So it, on a direct level, he helped to instill a sense of purpose and mission and patriotism in the American fighting man. But overall, I think what they did was something really, I mean, it was flawed and it was uneven, but at its best it was very noble, which was to try to grapple with their instincts as patriots to help the war effort, with their instincts as directors to tell a good story, and with their instincts as men to tell the truth, and to kind of combine that into work that would bring home to the American public what this war looked like, felt like, sounded like, what its effect was on the soldiers, what we were trying to do. I mean, these weren't guys who were 18 or 19 or 20 years old. They were between 35 and 45, so none of them had to do this. And they realized that what they could contribute to the war was clarity and storytelling, and that's what they tried to do. And so I do think it was a major part of the war effort to try to get the American people to understand what this war looked and felt like.
Well, I've learned a lot from reading your book, and again, I encourage people to go out and get this. It's Mark Harris. It's Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War. I believe it's out in paperback now. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. Thank you.
Well, I'm trying, you know, I've got to promote my authors, especially when they have great stories like this. And I encourage people also to go to YouTube and look at the Why We Fight movies that are on there. I think you'll learn a lot about what was going on during the 1930s and 40s, because they, you know, we didn't get into the details about this, but Capra's really tried to explain why we were fighting the Japanese the way we were, and the history of how Japan had taken over China and so forth, and what Hitler had done and what Mussolini had done. It's a great history lesson for all of you out there, and I encourage you to go out and purchase the book and check out all these movies.
And thanks so much. Yeah, and you can also find Let There Be Light and the Battle of Midway and San Pietro on YouTube as well.
I did. I also saw some cartoons from Disney and from Warner Brothers on there, too.
Right, those are great, the Private Snafu cartoons.
They are, and they're really, you'd be amazed that, you know, we think about stereotyping and we talked about earlier, and it's just, it's outrageous. Today, people, both sides of the political aisle would be just so upset by those
things.
So, Mark Harris, I want to thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio, and I would love to have you back on again at some point and talk about some other things about movies and war.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. That's another one in the can, as they say.
There we go.
And
that's a wrap.
That's a wrap. I don't know what number this is. It's probably somewhere around 570 or something like
that.
Give or take 20 or 30 of them. But I want to thank everybody for listening today.
Power?
I want to thank our sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans and Conway Truckload, for sponsoring the program. By the way, folks out there, we need some support from you also. We need you to go to our website, look on Support Veterans Radio. We've got some things that we want to try and do, and we need to start raising some funds to do that. So you'll be hearing more about our fundraising in the next couple of weeks.
No checks too small, no checks too big.
That's right. Plus, we'll send you a copy of our book, Vietnam Stories, The Best of Veterans Radio. And so we're going to get into our little music here, and then we'll be gone. And we'll be back next week, though, so we want to make sure that you tune in and listen to Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.